Dubai World Cup delivered a 30th anniversary to remember. Constitution Hill won again under the floodlights. And Albert Einstein flopped on his seasonal debut as Guinea's favourite. The flat is back. The front page has it covered. To the front page. I'm Tom Kerr. I'm your host for today's episode, and I'm delighted to be joined by Chris Cook in the studio and Matt Rennie dialing in. We've got a packed show ahead because, as I said in the open, the flat is well and truly back. We had some spectacular racing under geopolitical clouds in Dubai. We had the Lincoln at Doncaster. We had Albert Einstein flopping at the Curra, and of course Constitution Hill with his latest stride forward in his new flat career. So loads to discuss. We're going to dive straight in, Chris, with the Albert Einstein story. Well, that was disappointing, wasn't it?
But I guess it depends what you expected, really. I think we've been well prepared by recent years for the idea that, you know, Aidan's not going to have his big names. Absolutely ready to go, you know, to the, in the peak of their condition in April or May, or definitely not early May anyway. So I thought there was even an element of he's running this horse in the Gladden Stakes at the Curra on Saturday because he wants to try and get from there to somewhere else. You know, this is a race on the way somewhere. It'll help maybe put an edge on him. So, I mean, I'd never really expected that that race was going to end up in an impressive performance. In the end, he's got beaten like a drum. And he's out to sort of, I think he can get 25s for the Guineas.
Yeah, 25s for the Guineas.
It sounds like Aidan wants to go back sprinting with him. I mean, maybe even he was thinking, let's just test this before we get to the Guineas and see, because I'm not sure if this horse is going to want to do a mile. And if that's the case, then he's had his answer, hasn't he?
Well, let's dwell on the race for a second, because, of course, it was an unusual preparation for a O'Brien horse.
Yeah, he doesn't usually Guineas,
doesn't usually have a prep run. He went off 11-10, absolutely. So it was a bit of a test, wasn't it? It wasn't a penalty kick. He probably was short of match fitness. Some observers at the track said he wasn't looking completely A1. But how bad was it really? What are we supposed to interpret it? Because, of course, the context here is that Aidan O'Brien, as he often does, has spent the winter talking up this horse and describing him as a superstar, basically.
I mean, the stuff he came out with a couple of weeks ago about Albert Einstein was just really, you know, even by Aidan standards, it was quite unguarded.
Didn't give himself fastest horse, I think he said.
There was maybe a little conditional in there somewhere, but he might be the fastest that we've ever had in Ballydoyle. Yeah. And an awesome horse and so much potential and so on. And he didn't really give himself any wiggle room for a disappointing reappearance. But, you know, maybe he trusts us all to be adults about it and just say, well, you know, this isn't the finished article.
Yeah.
This is a horse that hadn't run since May. And he'd only run then over 6 furlongs on good going. Now he's doing 7 on ground with plenty of cut. It's a very different thing. I was surprised that he was as short as 11 to 10. I mean, I know he was 6 to 4 on when they opened the betting on the race. But, I mean, I wouldn't touch him with a barge pole. I wasn't going to back him anyway. Yeah. You know, you could have offered me 5 to 1. I wouldn't have taken it. I'm sounding wise after the event. I'm sorry about that. I no way backed Big Gossy and didn't think about it. Made no money from the race. But it never seemed like a very promising idea to me. Anyway, you know, it gives Aidan a certain amount of clarity about his Guineas team. Gestad always looked like the more, you know, likely one, having been so close in the Dewhurst, you know, which is always the best trial for the Guineas. And now it looks like he'll go there. But I mean, I don't. You shouldn't be putting a line through Albert Einstein. I don't suppose many people will, given the way Aidan was talking about him recently. He's had a number of big name horses run really disappointingly their first time back as 3-year-olds, and then still turn out to be awesome talents.
Often, you know, in the Guineas itself, actually,
frankly. Yeah, exactly.
Which recent record is not so strong.
The pattern is get stuffed in the Guineas and win the Derby.
Yes. Know? Yeah. And Matt, just bring you in here. So O'Brien said of Albert Einstein, there's every chance he's going to be a sprinter. What did you think? Was that spin to sort of manage expectations? Because one thing you would say about his performance at the weekend was he didn't exactly look fast.
Ironically for his name, I just thought he wasn't the most cleverest performance that a horse could ever put up. I mean, look, in last year's Gladness Stakes, there was a classic winner that emerged from it. It was Camille Pizarro for Aidan O'Brien's stable. Obviously, he went and won the Prix du Jockey Club, and he was beaten in the Gladness Stakes. But when he went into it, he was off the back of winning a Group One. I think he won the Jean-Luc Lagardère at Longchamp on Arc Day. So he was an esteemed top-level performer and raced throughout the whole of his juvenile campaign. Was a far more forward horse than what Albert Einstein is at this stage. Yeah, I think it is managing expectations now. I think the sort of the excitement and the build up around this unexposed thing possibly being one of the greatest horses we were going to see this season has firmly burst. I think I saw that when Aidan said in the quotes to Conor Fennerly, our colleague yesterday, that Ryan probably rode Gustav because he's going to ride him in the Guineas. So Albert Einstein wouldn't be the number one hope in the 2000 Guineas anymore for Aidan O'Brien. I'm agreeing with Chris. He's mad. Maybe the cynic in me saying he could just be a horse that we've all talked up, and he ends up just winning a Group Three or running in Group Threes rather than being an out and out sprinter. You know, from what I was seeing, the Charles Darwin is the one that they think is going to be the absolute top notch sprinter this year. Yeah, I was disappointed. He's got a long way to go, and he's got a lot of learning to do in a real short space of time. If we think he's going to be a Guineas winner, as you said, it was just really unique because, even though we know Aidan's not really, we did an analytical piece a couple of weeks ago, and Aidan's sort of gone away from having this Guineas horse, and it's gone to the ultimate classic horse they want is the Derby, as we've seen with City of Troy or Gus Rodin. But all of his 2000 Guineas winners before that have gone there off the back of no prep runs and have gone straight to Newmarket. So if he is gonna be a Guineas winner, he's gonna have to be an absolute phenomenal superstar in the space of what? A month's time. Just feels like everything's up against Albert Einstein at the moment.
Well, the prices, as you noted, Chris, reflect that. Certainly, he's been relegated to a unlikely runner, I would suggest, low in the sort of.
I think he must be pickings. Fourth.
But you did in your front runner column today a sort of rundown of the Guineas market, very timely.
I do try. Yeah.
What do you make of it? Because you know it's really thrown things wide open. We now have sort of Boeco, a narrow fav. O'Brien probably relies on Gustad, but he's also got Puerto Rico in there. And seamless segue here. We have the Aidan O'Brien stable tour in today's Racing Post and online for Racing Post Plus subscribers. Did you like that? And he was notably positive about Puerto Rico. And I always think there's a bit of Kremlinology with O'Brien, and I've sort of spent my career trying to interpret why one quote means that they really like a horse and another one might mean that they don't,
it's
even though it's superficially.
It's such a nuanced game, isn't it? You get the same thing with Willie, I think.
You do, yeah. But I really thought they were glowing about Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
You know, sort of, he's done very well physically, scopey, strong, mind has gone the right way, could be one to take on the older milers and go to all the big group ones.
He might go
France, I suppose, is the suggestion.
But that was sort of what I was expecting.
Yeah.
And I mean, and that in the recent history, that doesn't seem to be in any way a sort of slight from the Ballet d'Oil perspective. Mm. You know, they sent some really good horses to the French Guineas. And he improved so much last year, it sort of slightly felt like maybe their expectations for him weren't that high to begin with, and he's impressed him with his performances on the track, which is how you want it. But I think he's won two Group Ones in France already, hasn't he? So it sort of feels like the natural thing to do to send him back over there.
What would be your current pick for the Guineas?
Desert Storm, is that right? I'm not even looking at the list right now. Charlie Appleby's number one runner, who was third, running on third in the Dewhurst, is the 12 to 1, I think, something like that. That appeals to me. It feels like a market where you've had a strong favourite there and basically everybody's taking position for or against him, and then just suddenly he's dropped through a trapdoor and everyone's looking around going, well, what on earth do we make of this now? Boeco's fav. I don't think he really deserves to be on the basis of what he was doing last year. You know, he's a good horse. He's an honest horse. He gives you everything. But is he going to be a classic winner? I think he's, you know, even now he's got about half a stone to make on the top performers in that race. So, I mean, Gestad and Guyuan that won the Dewhurst would seem to me the sensible choices as favourite. Whether you're going to back them to sort of to win a Guineas, I don't, you know, it wouldn't quite do for me.
Yeah.
But, I'm just that way. I don't get involved at single figure odds, you know.
Well, lots to unfold over the next month in the classics, Marcus. Just a word as well on the 1,000 guineas, because we've had a slight drift for Precise and Diamond Necklace going the opposite way after a setback, a minor setback.
Your temperature a couple of weeks ago missed some work, but Aidan sounding confident that she'll get to the race.
Well, lots to flow under the bridge.
I mean, if you're interested in her, and this is my issue with Gestad as well, you know, he's just got out of the habit of winning guineas, you know?
I mean, it's just not a priority. Clearly, you know, by comparison.
That's the bit I have trouble wrapping my head around, because it's always been a great race for Making Stallions. Mm. And he's got more wins in it than anybody. But he hasn't won the 2,000 guineas since 2019. And I think it's a similar tale in the 1,000. So, you know, it's a race on the way somewhere for these horses. And, Precise is an example where you'd feel at great risk if you were getting involved at short odds.
Let's move on to the Dubai World Cup. As mentioned, it was the 30th anniversary of the meeting in the Middle East. And it took place at a time when the region has been embroiled in war. There have been missile attacks, drone attacks across all the Gulf nations as Iran responds to the bombings from the US and Israel. But nonetheless, the meeting took place. Matt, you were supposed to be out there, of course, reporting for the Racing Post, unfortunately unable to do so. But some of the world's best horses did make the journey out there. And we were treated to Calandagan, Ombudsman and Forever Young all strutting their stuff. Let's start with Calandagan. Last season rated the world's top racehorse. And he certainly didn't do anything to undermine that reputation, did he?
Absolutely not. As you say, it was sunny in York on Saturday, reporting from the Dubai World Cup, but much, much more colder. Calandagan, look, could be nothing but incredibly impressed with that. One, I thought Mikhail Barcelona gave him an absolutely sensational ride on his comeback. It was almost like his Pour Moi one a few years ago, but it showed how much he's learned that he got to the front and stayed right down in the saddle to make sure that it looked even more cheeky. But it's just remarkable 12 months on from the 2025 Shima Classic that we were sat there. Calandagan is wearing the albatross on his neck of being the world's best racehorse for people to come out after he was beaten in the Shima Classic the year before, when it was, I think, his third of four Group One runners up in a row, and we were all calling him some not very kind names. This is a completely reformed horse from that. He's an absolute superstar. He was tanking all the way through the race, and it was never in doubt. And what impressed me the most was his turn of foot in the last sort of 100 yards when Mikhail pressed go. It's just, you know, it basically says the world is his oyster once more. It seems like, well, from what Francis Graffard was saying afterwards, they're not going to be resting on their laurels with him, because he's a gelding. He can go wherever he wants. There's no stud value for him. They're even looking as far as Australia in the Cox Plate down, obviously being at Flemington this year on a completely different track to Moonee Valley. And that's so exciting to see, that he can start his season in the midst of this geopolitical turmoil. Remember, in the weeks before, there was uncertainty whether he'd actually be going or not. But he's gone out there, travelled under difficult circumstances, put on an absolutely brilliant show again, and they've gone, yep, we'll keep him in Europe for a little bit, but we're ready to get the passport out again. Look, it's fantastic that we've got such a horse like him, and that as a gelding, he's really appreciated as well as the world's best racers. We know flat racing is all and more of it's about more commercial stud value and whatnot, but it's just a fantastic performance. And I can't wait to see him wherever he goes. He's developed probably my favourite flat horse in training right now.
And that's that, of course, is the beauty of the fact that he is a gelding, isn't it, Chris? Because it's so unusual to have a situation where the top performer in the world is a gelding and therefore is going to be in action, hopefully over a prolonged period of time. The world tour being lined up by connections with Breeders' Cup, Cox Plate, Japan Cup, all potentially under consideration alongside targets in Europe. You know, it's just incredible. Of course, the one race he won't be running in is the Arc.
And I mean, we're going to feel that again if he's going to be that sort of dominant presence in top class middle distance racing this year. And then you're trying to build up the Arc at the end of the year, where all the other big names will be going, for sure, in Europe anyway. And he just can't go, even though, you know that connections would love to go and win that race with him.
And French Racing, of course, very proud to have the world's top racehorse in Flandigan. They were sort of France Gallo putting out
rightly
press
so.
Releases and stuff, but not
but
in
he
their,
can't
not in
run
their
in their race. I mean, I sort of feel we've reached the stage where I never honestly thought there was a great risk in letting geldings run in the race. Mm. I'm sure, you know, the bloodstock industry will manage to struggle along. Despite that, it's not always going to be a gelding that wins the race. Some people get very annoyed about the advantage that they have over entires, and you know they're so much easier to handle. But you know, you can't preserve their genes for the future. I think they should clearly be allowed in the arc, and we should not be denying ourselves the chance to see Calandigan taking on everybody else in that great race at the beginning of October. In terms of him, I mean, I enjoyed his sort of trajectory last year. We know when he was sort of, you could tell he was bursting with talent, but not exactly showing it in races like the Coronation Cup. And then he came good at the end of the year, looking really amazing. He might now get to the stage this year where if he's just going to win everything with his head in his chest, it might get a tiny bit boring. I always appreciate competition at the highest level. So I hope we can keep finding from somewhere a horse that can serve up to him and make it difficult for him, or at least circumstances in which he's trying to prove something that we don't already know he can do, you know? Mm.
Well, one rival who he faced last year, Ombudsman, was also in action in Dubai. Pretty smooth under William Buick would be the summary. Would Ombudsman have a chance in a rematch with Calandigan?
Yeah, I don't see why not. You know, another year older. He didn't really land a glove on him last time, but he's such a quality animal. I figured he wasn't quite at his best that day. The Ombudsman that we maybe saw at Royal Ascot, he'd be a danger to anybody. So yeah, no, I'd love to see the two of them get back in the same race. He was another one. You know, his race at the weekend, he was fully entitled to win. I think was he 5-2 on?
And had plenty in hand of his rivals, as did Calandigan,
sure,
for that matter.
You know? It'd be just great to see them back, and it's the start of what's going to be a long year for them. I think John Gosden said he was only 90% ready. Mm. And, you know, Prince of Wales next at Royal Ascot. I think that's, even for a Group One, that's always a slightly underrated race. I really enjoy it. And hopefully, he won't be scaring horses away. Hopefully, there will be people coming there to sort of take him on, you know.
I hope so. Matt, lots more to pick out from Dubai World Cup. We could do an entire show on it. But what were your highlights from the rest of the card?
To be fair, Tom, the absolute standout for me was how good it was to see the riding talents of Connor Beasley shine on the big stage again. He had a double at last year's meeting in the Calia Classic and the Golden Shaheen, but he scooped the two Group 1 sprints this time round in a 376-1 double on Native Approach in the Alquaz sprint and Dark Saffron again in the Shima Classic. Look, I'm a massive, massive fan of Connor Beasley, and being biased, being based in the north, I think our riding talent pool up here gets criminally underrated in Britain. And he's gone out to the UAE for a fair while now and has developed an incredibly, incredibly solid and profitable partnership with Ahmed bin Harmash. I just wish it would transfer to over here and some people would give him a big chance from the Southern Powerhouse Yards, give him a big chance on the big stages at Royal Ascot and whatnot, because he's clearly proven he can do it on the grandest stage of them all. Some might say the biggest flat racing stage of them all. It's brilliant to see a rider from the north of England becoming a go-to major international jockey. Also on the card, Simon and Ed Crisford had an absolutely terrific, terrific day. Fairy Glenn winning the Dubai Gold Cup, even though she won over 1 mile, 1 furlong last time and was stepping up to 2 miles. So she's opened plenty of doors for herself. But all of their horses ran terrific and well, even in defeat. West Wind Blows was run down by Calandigan, but second in the Shima Classic, and you know, an unbelievable performance from a horse he'd been off for a long time as well. And Maydown ran a stormer in the Dubai World Cup itself. Look, we know that the Crisfords go out there for the winter, but they thoroughly target these sort of big days out there. The way their horses were running at that meeting suggests, I reckon, they could have a real, real good season coming up in Britain. I mean, they've got Xanthos in the 1,000 guineas anti-post market quite high up there, but the Beasley and the Crisfords, if they transfer their Dubai form to Britain, they're going to both be some retrospective forces this year.
Also, looking at a massive flat season is, of course, Constitution Hill, Chris. and how the carrot and Dubai were absorbing. But this was a highlight of last week, surely. Two from two.
It might have been the biggest talking point.
It probably was the biggest. I think undoubtedly, actually, in terms of sheer attention paid to it.
People will think that we do a lot of articles about this horse. But my goodness, they get read, don't they?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. The sort of the percentage of articles that we do about Conscious Neil versus the percentage of total attention paid is massively
skewed. He's taking over the game.
Oh, 100. I think there's I can understand it, though, because there's a huge fascination with it, isn't there? Because, you know, first of all, you've got this superstar who has had an incredible career, and then latterly, so many difficulties, so many setbacks, so much uncertainty. Now he is transitioning to a new code. It's almost like if Rafael Nadal decided to become a golfer or something. Like, you know, it's not quite as extreme, but it has that same code shifting curiosity.
Yeah.
And he's doing successfully. He's doing well. He's showing his class, okay, at a very modest level at this stage, but he is showing that he's enjoying himself, to use the words of Ryan Moore.
Yes.
And people are really, first of all, I think pleased to see him doing it.
Yeah, exactly.
But second, also interested to see how far he can go.
And I think the sort of public's affection for racehorses is a bit like ivy. It just grows and grows over time, which is why jumped horses get to be so popular. They stick around for years on end. He's been around a long time, probably. He hasn't maybe raced all that many times. And, you know, then he was suffering adversity last year, and people always love that. Now he's come back and he's winning again. It's you know, the absolute ideal situation to sort of create, public enthusiasm. There's got to be a limit to it, because realistically, he's still a 9-year-old ex-hurdler who's now going to be taking on some quite good flat horses that are half his age, literally half his age.
Well, not next up, though, because it looks like all roads lead to the John Porter Newbury. I'm lying in wait, Hamish. Another popular old stage at 10, I think.
Yeah,
10.
Yeah, 1 year older, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. You know?
So I was looking at Hamish, and I was looking at the Racing Post ratings that he's been putting up. I've always slightly had this feeling with him that they've campaigned him conservatively with a small C. You know, there have been times when I wish that they would pull the trigger in a Group 1, but instead they found a nice Group 3 somewhere that he won. I think a couple of seasons ago he went for a listed race at the end of the year and won by 5 lengths, and it's sort of borderline unfair to the other horses in the race. Constitution Hill is now being asked to be that kind of horse if he's going to sort of continue his progress and win, you know, Group 3 level. Which we all think he must be capable of. But in terms of ratings, I think he did 103 at Southall and then 90 at Kempton the other day. These are hard races to get big ratings in, because you're not taking on you know that kind of quality of opposition. You can clearly see that he can do better than he's being asked to do on those occasions. But how much better? Hamish has sort of been regularly running to 116. On Racing Post ratings in his races. So, you know, the level that Constitution Hill's been running to in his flat races, he's got to find another stone from there, really, to, you know, to be in the mix in a John Porter against a horse like Hamish, or, you know, there'll be other horses. It's a sort of Al Azzi kind of race. You can sometimes get some quite beatable flat horses in a John Porter. But, you know, take nothing for granted. It's going to be a really serious test for him, and I'm in my own mind, I'm kind of expecting a valiant third would be not a bad result, you know.
Yeah, that would be disappointing for the story.
It is going to be deflating when he's bound to get beat eventually, right?
Yes.
And I hope that people keep faith with him and retain their interest in the story, because it's still a great one. He doesn't have to be Pegasus. He doesn't have to mop up and kick all these flat horses to the side.
And as you say, you know, there is a limit on how far he can go. I think the odds, which are, I think, significantly influenced by the interest around him, have him as evens to win any group race. 12-1 to win Group 1. I think the evens, you know, might not be the world's worst bet ever. The 12-1 feels very optimistic indeed.
Who's taking that? I mean, hopefully nobody. there'd be a few weak group races around, wouldn't you? And Nicky Anderson's very canny. I mean, there was some initial talk, wasn't there, about going for the Melbourne Cup and all of this kind of stuff, by which time he's nearly 10.
Yeah.
And presumably by the time you get there, he's had to show his hand anyway, so he's going to be handicapped up to the top of his ability.
Yeah.
it just never seemed to me a good idea at all. But they're doing exactly the right thing. They're giving him an experience, you know, a couple of baby steps, and now he's going to be given a chance in, you know, what would quite often be a winnable Group 3. Mm. And we'll see what happens. And he's just down the road from his yard. It's a track he's been to before. You know, they're absolutely doing the right thing by the horse. And, you know, whatever happens, there will be other chances for him.
Will. Matt, the crowd at Newbury will undoubtedly be boosted by the participation of Contingent Hill. At Kempton, it was sort of three times what they might normally expect for a Wednesday or weather meeting, which three times not a lot is still not a lot. It's about 1,500 there. Great atmosphere and people cheering him in and clambering to get into good spots around the paddock and stuff. But is there a sense that, you know, the sport is maybe not capitalising on the interest this is generating so far? It just feels that 1,500 for Constitution Hill, given the huge interest we know that surrounds the horse, feels a little bit unambitious.
Yeah, it's a very good thing to raise, actually. I think where Southall greatly benefited from where Kempton did not was that his debut not only came around with the huge clamour of it being his very first start on the flat, which would have energised any racing purist no matter what, but they also had Friday Night Live, and they had the students, yeah, students making their armada down there from Nottingham, Leicester, wherever not, and for Kempton's one was just a without Constitution Hill on it, was just a run-of-the-mill Wednesday night, and it was Tretter Cornley where the horse is the show. The horses are the show. There was no extra music or acts or anything like that, or activities, which is, you know, which is fine. I'm sure they weren't expecting it. It must be hard to plan in 6 days in advance to get anything, but you'd think, yeah, let's, especially just after Cheltenham, the quiet weeks after Cheltenham in the end of March, let's ramp it up and see. Yeah, what can we do in a very short space of time to turn around to make it a real occasion to remember? We're getting into that part now where Newbury, it could be in mid-April, we could have a lovely Saturday, a sunny Saturday, which would get people out more than would do on a cold Wednesday night at Kempton. But you're right, I think there's a lot we can do. I hark back to, I remember when Stradivarius and Enable and Frank were all running around the countries and stuff, and we had, like, I can't think what they're called off the top of my head, but signs, essentially big signs on lollipop sticks that the crowd could have, and scarves and hats and whatnot. And I don't see why we can't do this with Constitution Hill wherever he goes now. As long as we sort of know a brief plan, I'm sure Newbury might be planning some stuff for Constitution Hill as well, being their local hero. We can capitalize on it. It's very rare you get these. I think it's very rare you get these such people's horses on the flat anyway. And it's almost like an open goal that we've had one of the best horses and almost a cult following from the jump scene come cross over to the flat, where you get it more often over jumps. So, yeah, you're right. Make the most of it while we can as well, because as he said, he's nine, we'll be going on 10 at the end of the year. So this might be the last season we fully see him in his pomp. So, yeah, full agreement with that.
I mean, yeah, any race could be the last, couldn't it, for a nine-year-old ex-hurdler. But yeah, it's interesting what Matt says. Where's the Constitution Hill merch?
Yeah.
There's got to be a market out there.
This is why a sport has a marketing arm, isn't it?
You know, to get behind this and push.
You know, people often say, and they've said it with Constitution Hill, you know, this is like evidence that the most powerful marketing tool the sport has is the horses. And it's true. But it's only really true when you have horses who have cultivated a public following, who have recognition. And we know they don't come along very often. So what we have with Constitution Hill, his incredible story, his vast ability, but also the ebbs and flows of his success and talent over the years, you know, these are really rare.
It's a gift, isn't it, to the sport? And yeah. Now that you're saying that, I feel like we are slightly in danger of squandering it. You know, so let's hope there's a big marketing push to get people to Newbury, because you know, they've been given plenty of warning.
That's
the target.
And Constitution Hill merch. That's the stuff. someone could be making good money from this. let's move
but
on.
But also, you know, giving stuff to the fans, you know, that they can have and hold forever, and it bond them to the sport.
Well, exactly, you know, exactly. Yeah,
the horse's image in a mug. You know, you see every day.
I vividly remember sort of the Cheltenham clashes between Kortistan and them, and where the sport really leaned into it. And then, of course, Imperial Command, the one which is a
that was a great thing for classic scarf manufacturers. It was.
They talk warmly about it.
You must get misty-eyed about
Denman v. Corto. British Scarf Manufacturers Council, yeah. Let's move on to the week's big industry story, which, of course, is that levy reform has been taken off the table by the government 3 years after. Three years of review, which I think is a technical term, because I think what actually happened was someone went, Christ, we've got to do something about this levy thing that we said we'd do 3 years ago. And then they've gone, tell them no.
Yeah, let's just give it the bullet.
Yeah. So no one's surprised by that. If anyone is surprised that the government is not going to spend time legislating around the levy, then they're probably not paying that much attention to the travails of the current administration. The BHA, of course, said it was disappointing. They had to. Racing-friendly MPs said the sport had been let down. Again, both fair comments. But the interesting thing is that it's been thrown forward, and Brant Dunshay, the BHA chief executive, and those racing-friendly MPs both said, well, in return, please do something about affordability checks. They are having a huge impact on the sport's finances. But the concern is that the Gambling Commission is actually now looking at implementing a new regime of checks that have been piloted over the last couple of years. It's been a very troubled pilot. There are concerns that actually what will happen is that this new system, which is designed to be frictionless, actually will end up trapping lots more punters in manual checks than had
and
previously
it's
been the
starting
case.
Starting in May, isn't it?
It's it like could it's start as early as that, yeah.
Right there over the horizon, right at the start of the flat season.
So that's what the industry is asking for, effectively a quid pro quo. You've done us over in the levy, now give us a break with affordability checks. You know, does that logic hold politically? Does the sport have a chance here? Does it have leverage?
I don't see the leverage.
No.
And I'm full of fear, because I think we've just seen, haven't we, with that no over the levy, exactly how much influence we have in government. And exactly how much in the way of favours they feel like doing us. The affordability stuff has got so far down the tracks. It's clearly not going to be frictionless, like, you know, everybody's been saying, you know, it must be frictionless, you know, it's not going to work otherwise. But all the feedback seems to be that they just can't make it work in a frictionless way.
No.
Big surprise. So it's going to be damaging. It's going to end up getting in the way of enthusiastic followers of racing, taking people away from the legitimate market, the regulated market, and, you know, a portion of them will end up going towards the black market. So it will be entirely counterproductive in terms of the original intent behind it. It's a pretty dismal lookout.
And the limits that they're going to be imposing. So this sort of affordability checks, of course, have existed for years, but they've always sort of existed in this sort of slightly odd grey zone, in that they exist as a consequence of a requirement for bookmakers to consider affordability as part of their customer interactions. For the first time, this would actually define the levels at which those checks should take place, and it would be £1,000 over 24 hours, or £2,000 over I think is it 90 days or 30 days? I can't actually remember now. It's been so long since these have been implemented. But nonetheless, either of those limits, the possibility is that you're going to get people who are, yes, okay, still relatively big punters, but people who, you know, maybe are going to Cheltenham over a series of days and placing a bunch of £50 bets could hit those limits. That's entirely possible.
Yeah.
Owners
of
racehorses could hit those very easily. Anyone who's sort of a punter of significant means is going to be in the firing line. And so ultimately what this could mean is just tens of thousands of people who previously had the ability to bet through the regulated market suddenly discovering that the requirement is for them to engage with, you know, pretty intrusive and burdensome checks.
I mean, these are going to be some of racing's most important, most significant supporters will get trampled up in this.
Yeah.
And who knows what the consequences will be. You know, it might easily be in some cases that it kills off their attachment to the game. And, you know, we heard last week with the Alan Spence story, you know, about the potential that there seems to be for, you know, high-rolling people to just...
Because this is a story. Alan Spence, racehorse owner, classic-winning racehorse owner, was for many years betting with a unlicensed bookmaker, bet hundreds of thousands of pounds. He got took to court and was made to repay unpaid debts to that. But that's the underlying story, is that this very prominent racehorse owner, who also had a senior position in the Racehorse Owners Association, was using a unlicensed bookmaker who pays nothing to the sport, doesn't pay levy, doesn't pay tax. And that has proliferated massively over the last few years. I mean, I speak to punters on a regular basis. I speak to owners on a regular basis, and they all tell me the exact same thing, which is, you know, I get texts out of the blue. They're basically being passed around on databases, and people know who the big owners and punters are. In some cases, I suspect, because former VIP managers at bookmakers have moved into the black market, and they're being approached and offered betting services with none of the friction that is present in the regulated market. It's rife.
And this is all stuff that the Gambling Commission has sort of publicly doubted for years. But you know, clearly is going on with disastrous consequences for the funding of the sport. To me, it's still just a very weird idea that anyone would risk a huge sum of money betting with an unregulated bookie. I mean, that just seems crazy to me. You know, it's risky enough betting with the regulated ones. But you know, evidently it does happen. And, you know, if you are that kind of high roller and you find yourself bumping into all kinds of red tape that you hate trying to bet the right way, then, you, of course, you can easily see why. You know, if your mate has been, you know, betting with George from the pub car park, then you might give that a try too, if it's going to be so much easier. And, you know, you're not going to have to send your financial details to people who you don't even know who they are, you know. There's a bunch of people who are bound to be tempted by that. We in terms of the regulation of gambling, a sea change is needed, clearly, because the real problems are not being addressed. That's what these news stories are telling us.
Yeah, Matt, the other big industry story over the last 7 days is the travails of Chelmsford, one of British Racing's newest tracks, which has had a pretty troubled existence over its years. And the latest chapter is that the company that operates it has gone into administration, needed special dispensation from the BHA to stage its meeting last week. And there is plenty of uncertainty about what the future holds for the all-weather track. What do you think happens next? Is it rescue? Is it a new operator? Is it something worse?
It's a sorry mess, really, isn't it? And sadly, that's been the case since Chelmsford's inception as Great Leagues all those years ago, when it then swiftly went into administration and was defunct for a fair few years, well, nearly half a decade, really. It's just, yeah, from reading the story, it's Great Leagues estates that are going into administration, and it's come from, you know, a pretty disastrous Justin Timberlake concert at the race course last summer, which has been scolded by the Chelmsford City Council in the way it was run. Yet the next company you're taking on, I think, is John Holmes, the founder of Chelmsford, who was on Great Leagues estates, is a director as well, obviously. As Lee said in his column, Lee White said in his column in Monday's newspaper, it is his baby, and you know, credit and kudos for having a go. But maybe a change in direction and a change in company is needed to try and improve the situation in there, whether that be coming under the banner of someone like the Jockey Club, in part of a bigger group rather than as an independent race course. It's just it's a complete sorry mess that you just feel it's just going to keep repeating itself time and time again unless many things are done about it. I mean, look, Chelmsford, I've been to Chelmsford, and it wasn't an enjoyable experience for me as a customer, given there's no grandstand there. But it's not, as Lee said, it's not like Cartmel, where you've got the Lake District hills around it and you can enjoy the views. It wasn't a nice experience to be there as a racing customer. Many many people might think that, and that might play into a part of why there's such financial strife there. It just feels like a story we're going to keep repeating year on year, essentially, or in a cycle of a couple of years. I don't actually know how it can all change, really. It's really sad to see. You never want to lose any or have any race course in fear of being lost, because they are our jewels and our assets. But this feels like one where you can see in a couple of years' time that we're going to be in the same situation and maybe even more perilous.
Yeah, we will see what unfolds at Chelmsford with dozens of meetings per year. It's an important part of the all-weather network. But we're back on the turf, Chris. That's the final chapter of this week's show is the return of the British flat turf.
Racing on turf.
It's begun. We've got Doncaster. We've had the Lincoln. I think the interesting thing, though, is actually what you raised beforehand, and it's just whether this works as a start to the season. No, I don't mean any disrespect to Doncaster, who sort of bookend the season with some fantastic days, but flat trainers, I think, have sort of given voice to this themselves over the years. This idea that they have their big bang, and then it's like, well, you know, back off the stage, please, actually, because we're going to go and do some big handicap chases now.
I mean, I think anybody who's sort of really in the flat racing world and has been for a few years, it kind of feels like it's a false dawn, isn't it? Mm. I mean, it's a big day in itself, the Lincoln. But, you know, nothing like as big as it was. You know, you'd remember 80s, 90s when it was a three-day meeting and, you know, there'd be a lot made of it. It'd get much wider media coverage than it does now. You know, every newspaper, you know, there'd be something on the back page flagging up the fact that the flat is back. All the racing cars would have their list of horses to follow for the year ahead. And it would really feel like the start of something. You know, they would always start with the apprentice handicap, and a big fuss would be made of the fact that whichever young jockey happened to win would be leading the race to be champion jockey for, you know, for half an hour. And, you know, so now it's down to one day, and it's an impactful day. But as you say, then flat racing goes a bit quiet for weeks, really. I mean, if you're a sort of casual Saturday punter, the next connection you have with it might be the Guineas.
John Porter. Come on.
Well, okay. Yeah, this time. But you can't have a Constitution Hill every year. I mean, it's because you have the Grand National, and that's still such a huge betting event. And then you've got the Scottish National the week after, which rides Aintree's coattails to some extent. You know, it feels like punters have had such fun with Aintree that they're like, yes, we want to do that again. Scottish National's often in the top 10 of betting races for the whole year for that reason. And then you have the finale day at Sandown. And, you know, this time of year kind of has a momentum of its own, and there's even Punchestown coming as well. So I think, some people in flat racing do feel a bit resentful that they get the spotlight and immediately it gets dragged away from them. Well, talk about, is this, you know, if we can organise the season, is this the right way to start? Should we do it differently?
Well, to try and address the balance, because we are going to contribute to that problem by spending the next few weeks talking about the jumps exclusively. But to try and contribute as a closing beat for today's show, what's the story you are most interested in, most looking forward to seeing unfold in this flat season?
Do you know, one thing I did enjoy last year was the number of older horses that were kicking about in training. There were 7-year-olds that I latched on to. Anne Matt would be one. Unfortunately, he's retired now, but he didn't win last year, but ran gamely whenever he was at the races. Trollerman was 7 as well. There were 2 or 3 other sort of very high profile examples. And some of them will be back. And it feels like flat trainers are more prepared than ever they used to be, and owners too, to persevere with some of these horses. They're not all geldings. They're popular in the way that jumps horses get to be if they stick around for a long time. And, you know, Sir Michael Stout was always right. You absolutely don't get to the bottom of some of these horses until they're at least 5. And, you know, that's when you start to see the sort of the full extent of their toughness and resilience and durability and charisma and all these other qualities that we love in our racehorses. So I'm just appreciative of the fact that that does happen, and I'm hoping that we'll see more of it this year. You know, if we get Constitution Hill versus Hamish, that would set the tone beautifully.
That would. It would kick us off very nicely. Matt, last thought to you. What's the story you're most looking forward to seeing this flat season?
Probably Asphora back in the UK and doing what she does, strutting her stuff here for Australia. And I think they were hoping. I think she was going to be based over here now, sort of in the satellite yard for Henry Dwyer throughout the summer. I pray, hopefully, she's still in training and we'll be coming back here. I'm sure we can check in with Henry either this week or next. But she was a real, I, I've grown to really love her as well, in terms of those older horses from the flat who have come through and are just making, getting that public following as well. And she was brilliant in the Nunthorpe last year and the year before at the King's Stand. So I'd love, well, the King Charles III Stakes, as it's now known. So I'd love to see her do so well in Springs Division was pretty weak last year, but I'd love to see her sort of dominate that. Love Calandigan as well. Again, it's this recurring theme. These older horses, if you keep them in training, people latch onto them emotionally and will come and see them. So yeah, I'd really like them too. I've just got actually a bit of breaking news from just got my phone popped up that and it links back to a story that we've been rumbling on with since January, Cheltenham's Trials Day. Cheltenham's two-day meeting and the Hunt to Chase meet had been cancelled there for the end of the season to do drainage works. So it's clear there was quite a big issue there. But the Craven meet will have it stand out on its own now. But yeah, the came through from a Jockey Club press release that they've confirmed the final three race days of the 2025-26 season at Cheltenham have been cancelled to allow for an upgrade of drainage systems on the home straight. So it was quite clear there's a more serious, well, it was incredibly serious, as we know, on Trials Day, but the festival's been and gone, and there's still drainage issues at Cheltenham Racecourse. So we've got no April meeting this year. The races are just looking at them. A few of the races have been allocated elsewhere, especially the mares and the fillies finals have gone to other Jockey Club racecourses. But yeah, it's the drainage saga's returned at Cheltenham.
Well, that is extraordinary, and that does suggest actually that the meeting, the festival itself, may have been under some threat, given the need to cancel meetings rather than to simply wait until the jump season was over.
Yeah, I mean, I guess there's going to be an awful lot of groundwork involved if you want to upgrade your system after however many years it's been. So maybe they'd just rather crack on with that.
Yeah.
I didn't get any breath of concern in the build-up to the festival time. So yeah, it's interesting. We'll hear their explanation in due course. But you know, personally, I've got to say I'm absolutely gutted because I love those sort of back end race days at Cheltenham, and there's not much more fun than being at Cheltenham watching good jumps racing and also seeing the Craven meeting on the aways.
Well, not this year.
I shall actually have to go to Newmarket.
Floated the issue of the jump season needing to be recalibrated to allow the flat to breathe.
There we go.
It is already happening. Congratulations. The power of the media and Chris Crook specifically there. We'll leave it there. Thank you very much for you at home for watching. Thank you to my panellists. We will be back next week with all the big stories from the racing world. And until then, goodbye.